This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but it has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program. Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week, we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This woman calls Melbourne home and is a recognisable name amongst the lesbian community. You may have known her from her previous work as the Festival Director of Melbourne's LGBTI Arts and Cultural Festival Midsummer, where she proved that operating strategically, developing community partnerships was the ticket to managing the stakeholders' expectations. But in the last year or so, she has been making a name for herself as the CEO of Joy, the very radio station you're listening to now. And while she has made no secret about her passion for the LGBTI community, it's been her work at Joy that has proven that she is interested in the future growth and success of our community radio station. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Tennille Moisel to Word for Word.
I guess I had an interesting childhood. I mean, it's the only childhood I've ever had.
Joy CEO Tennille joins us now to discuss the change in culture and direction for the station this year.
Because it wasn't just a matter of saying, hey, we're not going to be a gay lesbian radio station anymore, we're going to be an LGBTI radio station. We actually have to change our community of interest with ACMA. There are no other gay and lesbian or LGBTI radio stations, so we basically had to create that. It is a constant challenge. We're increasing the size of our teams. We want people to be more collaborative in the way that they produce radio. For us at Joy, the days of one person sitting in a studio on their own, panelling, hosting, doing everything, those days are not the future for us.
How is it being a CEO of one of Melbourne's biggest LGBTI community organisations?
It's pretty exciting, actually. And what's interesting about Joy is it's actually the largest LGBTI membership-based organisation in Australia.
Some of these people in a lot of these articles, they're putting your ability under question. They're questioning your ability.
That kind of comes with the territory, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I'm a woman in charge. I am going to be questioned. Because, I mean, that's kind of ultimately what we're all here for. When we communicate with people and we build relationships, it's about sharing experiences. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is either going to be a lot of fun, or I guess this is going to end really badly with me losing my job, right?
Well, no, I don't think it could end that badly, could it? That's a bit terrifying.
I remember once hearing a story about someone from the ABC, I think it was, who interviewed the CEO, and then it was sort of rumoured that he lost his job straight afterwards.
Oh.
So that's the reason why I'm saying that.
Oh, I'll hold off at least a week. No, just joking.
You're off the grid. What has been the biggest turning point in your career thus far?
Wow. Oh, okay. Would be when I actually chose to come and work in community. So I worked in the corporate sector for 15 years and then I woke up one day and I was just like, what am I doing with myself? And I actively chose to work in community.
Did you ever think that you would be running a multifaceted business like Joy?
No. When I kind of reflect back, my tertiary education was all in the arts. So I got a double degree in theatre and creative writing and also film. So I started out in those spaces. And my dad had always said to me when I got into uni, I can't congratulate you until you're making money out of that degree. So it wasn't until 5 years ago that my dad said congratulations on getting a degree.
A long time coming.
Yeah. In a weird kind of way. He said, oh, well, you've now done it.
You grew up in Queensland.
mm-hmm.
instead of far north Queensland. What was your childhood like?
I guess I had an interesting childhood. I mean, it's the only childhood I've ever had, so I think it was great. Born in Bundaberg and I grew up in Cairns, and my dad was a prawn fisherman. He still is. So my dad was away for 9 months of the year. So it was just mum and me and the kids, as we used to call it, because I'm the oldest of four kids. So it was mum and I and the kids. And no, we were poor. I grew up in poor Cairns. You know, people laugh like I talk about it, and it's like, yeah, we didn't have to wear shoes to school, and, you know, and that's actually true. We didn't. Like, rarely wore shoes to school, and it was just hot, and, you know, lots of, I don't know, just, it was a pretty crazy childhood, actually. My parents were really focused on making sure that we had fun. Like, it was a lot of laughter in our house, so just, I don't know, you could get out of anything if you could make mum laugh.
What would you say is your earliest memory from when you were a child?
I have a really, really vivid memory of being, and I would have been not quite two, because I can remember my mum being home with my brother, who's almost 2 years younger than me. And I have a really vivid memory of coming out of my bedroom in the morning, dad being in the kitchen making boiled eggs, and mum breastfeeding my brother on the couch. And I remember it like it was yesterday.
Wow.
I don't know anything outside of that, but I remember walking down the hallway, dad's making boiled eggs and mum's breastfeeding.
Breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And you've been trying to get that memory out of your head ever since. What was your relationship like with your parents as you were growing up?
Yeah, I think we're close, but we're a really unusual family. So I will speak to my mum, every week, every couple of weeks. It could go a month and we don't talk. But when we do, there's no big deal about that. Like, we just talk and tell each other what's happening, and we're pretty close. I mean, she was the first person I ever came out to, so, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're pretty close. A lot of people find this really weird. My dad and I, we're close, but I will speak to my dad twice a year, maybe a few more times, but I only see him once every 2 years because he's still based up in Queensland and I'm down here, and he doesn't like the cold and I don't like the heat. But no, we're a close family. I know that my mum and dad will always be there to support me, but we don't see each other all the time.
It's funny, that's the common story for a lot of people. I mean, as we grow up, we're so close with our families. Mm. But then as time goes on and we start to move to different places of the world, or for you, different state, it does sort of fracture the relationship a little.
It changes it. I moved out of home at 17 and a half. I finished high school and I knew I had to get out. So I've been out of home since I was 17. And when I moved out of home, like, they were in Cairns, I moved to the Gold Coast. So it wasn't like I just moved out around the corner. I left.
Did you have a role as you were growing up in the family, like within your siblings? I mean, you said that you had four siblings, so it's a rather big family.
Yeah.
Did you have a role that you played with your siblings?
Oh, I was the oldest. I was in charge. Absolutely. I've been called bossy from the day my brother was born. With dad being away 9 months of the year, mum worked. So from when my younger sister was in school, it was my job to take the kids to school and to bring them home from school, and then mum would come home, you know, sort of half an hour after that. But, you know, this is like the 80s, so it wasn't a big deal for kids to, you know, how old was I, Amber? So I was 11 and looking after two brothers and a sister. But that wasn't uncommon then.
No.
I can remember, like, mum worked at the Pizza Hut, so it was about 3 kilometres away, the Pizza Hut, and I can remember school holidays. Once a week during school holidays, we were allowed to go to the Pizza Hut for lunch, and so I'd get my two brothers and my sister, so I would have been probably 12 the first time I did this, and we walked 3 kilometres into the Pizza Hut for lunch, and then I walked them home, and it's kind of funny to think about now, but no, I was definitely the boss, yeah.
It's also funny when you look at the dynamics of the relationship you have with your siblings, it's so common to then see the telltale signs of what's going to happen in your life later on.
Yep, yeah,
definitely. Here you are being the CEO of Joy.
Yeah, kind of taking on leadership roles. I've done a lot of leadership.
What did you think of school growing up?
I loved learning. I hated school. I hated the politics of school. Mm. I was never a cool kid. But I also didn't realise that was a big deal. I just remember thinking that people were stupid. My dad used to always say to us, what other people think about you is none of your business. So people would say, like, I remember we changed schools when we first moved to Cairns. I was in year four. And on the first Monday I was there, this girl came up and slapped me. And I was like, that's a bit weird. Welcome to a new school. And throughout the day, I worked out that she was angry because I was Nicholas Dombrowski's number 3, because there were these guys, and on Monday mornings they'd call out their top 10 girls. And my first week there, I'd made it to number 3 on Nicholas Dombrowski's list. So this girl slapped me across the face.
She was devastated.
So, yeah, I'm just like, well, that's a bit weird.
She's probably married to him now.
Probably. But no, I just always remember there being, you're not really caring about the people. And I used to say to, in particularly in high school, that I couldn't wait to the day I never had to see any of them again. So I didn't like the people. I'm actually not friends with anyone from school. So,
well, would you say that that meant that you had sort of awkward teenage years then?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, like, I'm pretty happy with how I went through being a child and being a teenager. I just always had this perspective that it didn't matter. Like, the stuff that happens when you're a kid doesn't matter, and that we're just kind of surviving those years to get to being an adult to actually have purpose in the world. So I just always had that kind of perspective that you just had to get through this sort of childhood period and then you could be free.
I wish that I had that mentality. You know, I think it's a good way to look at things.
Well, flash forward to 35, when I was 35, so 7 years ago, I was doing some work with some young people and they were talking about bullying, and I couldn't wrap my head around bullying. And then I went, oh shit, I was bullied. I didn't realise. Because I used to just look at these people and just think, how small are your lives that you have to pick on me? You don't even know me.
The fact that you brought that up, like, bullying, I think, is a weird word for people to use, because I think 9 times out of 10, we aren't aware that we've been bullied, and we aren't aware that we may have bullied someone. And that's why it's so important to arm yourself with information of knowing what cultivates that.
Absolutely.
And so for me, when I look back at school, there was some behaviour that I had, or I was held accountable for, even when I did Big Brother. Someone wrote a story about me being a bully on that show. And I thought, you know what? I kind of was.
Mm.
And it's interesting. Once I knew what constitutes that, you can avoid it and you can also protect yourself from it.
I think knowing about it's really, really important. I always think about The Breakfast Club, and I think that it's that movie, everyone should watch that when they're probably 10, 15 and 20. And to have a look at that and realise that all of those people were caught up in this kind of bullying cycle. You know, they were either the victim of, they were either being bullied or being bullies themselves. And they were caught up in this cycle. But that movie tells us that it's actually really insular. Like, none of that's actually about the other people. It's all about their own circumstances.
Absolutely.
And I've always had this really kind of weird perspective on that, is that we grew up in a really poor area in Cairns. The people next door to us, there was a single dad and he had 3 kids. And every time our parents left the house, the two, and this is quite actually traumatic. Well, it's not traumatic because I'm not traumatized by it, but it's actually full on. The two boys who were teenagers at the time would jump the fence, climb through our windows and terrorize my sister and I, chase us around the house. And so we knew that if mum and dad left the house, we had to lock all the windows and protect ourselves. And, you know, when we told our parents, obviously, then we got security screens, which was a very big extravagance. But I grew up in that kind of world that it was like, okay, well, I'm not going to engage with those people because they're dangerous. I'm just not going to engage with them. And I told my mum and dad about it and we did something about it. But I don't know. It's just a really kind of weird perspective that even though those people did that, I would look at those guys and I would say, geez, your dad's an alcoholic. You don't have a mum. That must be really shitty for you. You know, what a shitty life. And I used to, I don't know, I just always sort of thought this, what they're doing isn't necessarily what they want to do. It's just what they are doing because they don't know how to control the rest of their life. And I've always had that kind of perspective whenever people have said stuff or done stuff to me. I've had, you know, stupid, we all have, we've all got those sort of histories, but I've always looked at people and just sort of thought, well, wow, you don't have a perfect life. And those cool kids at school, I used to look at them and just think, wow, that's not, you're not perfect. Your life is not perfect. You're in pain. So I just used to think, whatever.
It's good though that I think in some ways that you were able to work out how to deal with that, even if you weren't really that conscious about it. Like when you're listening to that story, you can see that you probably worked out ways on how to protect yourself.
Or just not make it a focus for me.
Yeah.
I guess so.
Well, you can't really take ownership over someone else's problem most of the time.
No, well, that's their behaviour. I can't control their behaviour.
Exactly.
And I know, I mean, like, I wasn't inviting them to jump through my window and chase me around the house with a knife. I wasn't inviting that.
Who would?
Who would? But, you know, in that moment I was thinking about my little sister and making sure she was safe and then telling my mum and just not standing for it. But just conscious of it.
What were your hobbies and interests as you were growing up?
Okay, that's a funny one for me. I was never into sport, except I did do a little stint in netball when I was about 15, and I had a mixed netball team. I was the captain because why not? So I did play. I played, you know, what you do around school, but always, I mean, I've been reading since I was, you know, way before school. I love reading. I think reading is one of the best things that you can possibly do in life to kind of escape into another story and to have that kind of perspective and that mind-altering experience of utilizing your imagination to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. I just think is one of the best things you can do.
What age did you start to think about your sexuality?
So I, and my mum will listen to this and she will go, yep, I knew it. When I was 11 and 12, I started having really close female friends. It's kind of a weird thing to look back on. I look back on it and I realise what was happening at the time. Do you know what I mean? And it sounds so weird. Oh, it's not really weird. It's quite natural and normal, but there was definitely activity that wasn't labelled and it wasn't articulated and you knew not to talk about it. And I mean, that was from, from being year six, year seven, right through. But what's interesting about that is that the labels didn't come until much later for me. So I was brought up as a girl with all of the same, you know, stories and dreams, like, you know, one day you'll meet a guy and you'll fall in love and you'll get married and you'll have a baby and then you'll be a mum and, you know, then you'll have a house. And I mean, that's just what we're all brought up with. So for me, there was this thing kind of happening at night with friends and there was never any talking about it. And then, I mean, I had boyfriends, which was weird, you know, didn't mind the kissing.
Nothing else.
After that, it was just like, what are you doing? Like, it wasn't until I left. So when I left Cairns, it was to go to uni and I did my arts degree and all of a sudden you start learning different language and all of a sudden you start realising that word lesbian isn't just a slur. It's not just something somebody says to you to be nasty. It actually has a meaning and it's actually part of an identity that you get to claim. Mm. So it wasn't until, I was around 18 that kind of all clicked for me.
When or how did you first see homosexuality? Like, not your first experience, but your first acknowledgement of it.
Yeah. So my mum had a cousin who moved to Cairns when I was probably 14 or 15. He was very out, very gay, very fabulous. And mum never hid that from us. And she also had a friend who she worked with at the Pizza Hut who... And this actually got quite confusing because he had a girlfriend, but then he came out. So there was obviously a whole heap of stuff happening there. And that was around about the same time. So these two gay men, and interestingly, one of my fondest memories of mum's cousin was he worked at one of the resorts at Palm Cove in Cairns. And so we got to go and use the resort facilities one day. And I remember my brothers and sister were playing. And my mum, I don't know where my mum was, but I was sitting there with my mum's cousin. We're laying on the banana lounges and this guy walked past and I watched mum's cousin watch him and then he went into the toilets and then my mum's cousin got up and followed him.
Oh.
And I didn't know what that meant at the time, but I just remember thinking, oh, gosh, that could be a bit awkward in there if, you know, they're trying to impress each other.
My God.
Yeah. So, but then he also, for my 16th birthday, I got the three people who were my closest friends at the time. So another girl and two guys. And we went and saw My Own Private Idaho for my 16th birthday. Incidentally, we were all gay at the time.
I do remember my Own Private Idaho, though. That was a fairly graphic film.
Yeah.
I mean, sexuality in that film was probably more in your face than what we'd seen before.
Yeah. It was also, I mean, you know, the quirkiness of Gus Van Sant stuff, but, you know, also talking about sex workers and talking about all of this stuff that, you know, you just didn't see.
He covered a lot.
He did.
In that movie, let me tell you.
He did.
When was it that you had your first relationship then?
So actual relationship was when I got to uni. So when I was 18. Yeah.
You know what's funny about that is that sometimes when it comes to our sexuality, we wait until we have a relationship to come out. But what was it like for you?
So for me, I kind of came out, it was kind of around the same time. So it wasn't because of, but it was at that same time because it was kind of, I guess for me, it was like, okay, this girl and I, and we ended up together just kind of, you know, within a month or so of me coming out. But yeah, it was kind of at the same time and it was an interesting time. Yeah.
But did you come out to tell your mum? Is that when you told your mum that you had a girlfriend?
My mum was the first person I told. So I'd been at uni for a year and I came home and mum was hanging, washing out on the line and I was standing in my room. It was technically not my room, obviously, but it was the room that it had been mine.
Yeah.
And I was looking out the window through the security screens that were put there for my own safety. I said, "Mum, I need to tell you something." And she's like, "Oh, yeah, what?" And I said, "I'm a lesbian." And she said, "Oh, are you sure?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sure." And she goes, "Maybe you just need to sleep with more boys." And I said, "No, I've done that, and no." And she's like, oh, this is going to kill your dad. It's going to kill my dad and it's going to kill my grandparents.
And they're the fears, though, that every child has.
Like, 100%.
That's the first thing your mum said to you, was actually a realisation of every fear that a child has.
I actually didn't worry about that. I remember actively saying, well, that's just the way it's going to have to be. And I said to mum, well, okay. And I can't remember if it was that day or the next day that I flew back to the Gold Coast. But then mum used to ring me every week. And so the next time she called me, she said, okay, well, I've told your dad. And look, he loves you. You're his daughter, so he still loves you. So, okay, cool. And then the week later, now I've told your grandparents. So when I actually look back on it, I came out to my mum.
She came out for you.
She came out for me. And so even to this day, it hasn't happened for actually a few years, but she'd say, oh, I ran into Maria Twaddo, an actual name of a person I went to school with, ran into Maria Twaddo the other day. And I said, oh, right, yeah, it's been years since I've seen her. How's she? She's good. I told her you're a lesbian. And I said, oh, okay.
God, mum.
Does she need to know that? Like, how did that come up in conversation? She goes, well, I just thought she should know. So my mum went from all of the things that she was fearful of, and it makes sense, to, well, she's my daughter, I'm going to have to support her. And she then, you know, has been the most supportive person ever. Years later, she told me that she went and she's like, right, well, I'm going to have to work out how to support Tennille. And she did a lot of research and spoke to a lot of people. And at one stage, I thought she was going to be the most active PFLAG mum ever. Interestingly, my sister was 12 at the time, and I didn't know until only a few years ago that me kind of flying into Cairns and saying, oh, P.S., I'm a leso, and leaving actually had impacts on my younger sister, who, she was a dancer, so she'd go around to all of the Steadfords and everything, and she was telling me when she was 12 that these girls were saying, oh, you're a leso, you're a lemon. And Amber said to mum, what's a leso or a lemon? And mum said, oh, they're calling you a lesbian. And my sister turned around to them and said, yeah, well, my sister is, so of course I am too.
That's one way of competing it.
She, my sister is not a lesbian.
She's not a lesbian. Okay.
She's not a lesbian, but she did counter the taunts of the other
young
people.
She was proud
people.
Of her big sister.
Yeah, no, they've all been pretty good. They've all been pretty good.
Do you think it's easier these days for people to come out? Compared to what it was like back then?
You know, I don't know about that. I don't know about that because we kind of look at popular culture and say, well, there's more representation and there's more examples of family and friends being super cool about it and encouraging. But I actually really like that I had to go almost 2,000 kilometres away from my family to go on a journey and then come back and say, hey, this is actually who I am. I wouldn't change that for anything, because for me there was a power in claiming my identity without it actually being presented to me as an option. And I don't want to say that in any kind of negative way, but honestly, lesbian, leso, lemon, they were just taunts. And you kind of knew what the definition was, but you knew that what they actually meant was something nasty. And you didn't quite really understand that there was this option to claim an identity that meant that you proclaimed that you were same-sex attracted. Like, that wasn't ever a plan for me. I was the person who was going to grow up, meet a guy, get married, have a baby, be a mum. I knew I never wanted to do that, but there was never an alternative. I mean, I remember my dad and I having a huge argument when I was 15. I didn't want to go back to school. And he said to me, well, you can drop out. Maybe you can be a travel agent or a secretary. And I looked at him and I was crying, very dramatic. And
the assigned roles that we give our children based on their sexuality are horrific.
He wasn't trying to be derogatory. He was just basically saying, well, if you don't want to do school, there's options for you. And that was probably the best conversation I ever had with my dad, because it made me not want to be any of those things. I knew I had to finish school. I knew I had to go to university. No one encouraged me to. No one talked about it, but I knew that's what I had to do to get free.
I'm sure that my dad would have said to me, Ben, you could be a hairdresser.
Yeah. Well, Ben, hairdressing.
You know, if you could go back in time, and what advice would you give young Tennille?
Never give up. Just keep going. Like, just, yeah, you're going to be fine.
Don't worry about those taunts about being called a lemon.
Just don't give up ever.
What's been the career highlight thus far?
I don't know. I've had lots of varied things happen. I was known in my last job, or the job before Midsummer, the corporate job, I was known as the person who could fix anything. So, I mean, I used to be able to go into the CEO and she'd say, right, Tennille, what do you need to fix this problem? And if I said a kilo of glitter and a unicorn, she'd laugh and say, okay, whatever, let me go and do what I wanted to do. The things that I'm probably most proud of is where we've been able to, here at Joy and then also at Midsummer, kind of overcome some historically poor relationships. And that will always be a challenge. But I do think that I've had some really good conversations with people who've been upset and been able to find a way to work with them again.
You've seamlessly been able to break into shaping businesses. What drew you to this type of work?
Oh, it was all accidental. So I graduated with a theatre, a Bachelor of Arts in Creative Arts with a double major in theatre and creative writing. Then I went and did film and television and I couldn't make any money. So I'm making lots of films and doing lots of theatre and, you know, having the dream of, oh, I'm going to go to Edinburgh and have a festival show and all of those sorts of things, and then realising, crap, I need to make money. I ended up being very good at talking and ended up being very good at telemarketing. Things kind of came up and I just threw my hat in the ring, like, oh, team leader, oh, yeah, I'll give that a go, and I do the assessment and get the job and be very good at it, and then another job would come up and I'd, oh, yeah, okay, I'll give that a go, and I just kept getting the jobs. I don't know why business makes sense to me. So with like a client situation or even just managing people, I understood how to kind of say, okay, well, at the core of it, what is it that you need or want? What is it that we need to achieve together? And is that going to match? And if it doesn't match, well, then we have to, you know, part ways. But if it does match, cool. This is then the plan that we're going to work together and we're going to achieve those things. So I just had an ability to do that. And I just kept getting opportunities to use my curiosity and solve bigger problems. And I just kind of found that interesting.
You took a job working for Stella. So you worked for Stella, you know, in different roles over about a 10-year period.
15,
is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What did that whole experience at Stella teach you?
Just, I was really blessed. That organisation had a lot of really, really strong women in really key management roles. And I am conscious now that that's not always the case for people. So in terms of role models, whether they're official or unofficial, I got to see women making decisions and, you know, calling the shots on stuff and also supporting and mentoring. So those same women would sort of say, okay, well, Tennille, we've got this project on. Do you want to be part of the project team? And I was just always really happy to learn, like, oh, cool, how do you do that? And they'd show me and I'd be like, oh, okay, well, and I'd go off and do it. And, well, couldn't I do it this way? And they'd be like, well, yeah, that's another way to do it. So just the support in that organisation was amazing.
The thing that stays with me from that is how important and how rare it is for you to have been cultivating your career whilst there were women in places of power.
Oh yeah.
Making you consciously and subconsciously believe that you could do it.
In terms of being a woman and facing criticism that is unfounded in any kind of rational rational allegation, and actually seeing women sort of saying, well, hang on a second, no, we're not going to talk about that, this is actually the issue, I'm bringing it back on track, was something that, yeah, I mean, I from a professional perspective, I guess I just grew up surrounded by that. And it wasn't until I was well in my 30s and I had a new manager come in who was male, and he came and he said to Tennille, you have no idea what this has done for you, having all of these women and you growing up with that, you have no idea how good that's been for you. And I didn't really think about it until then. And then I started reflecting and realised that, yeah, I've been surrounded in this organisation. Not, I didn't always report to women, but there was always women in positions of power who were showing me that, yeah, it was fine. It wasn't a big deal.
I think it's so powerful. How did you end up at Midsummer? Because, you know, you decided to walk out of a corporate job And then you were volunteering to start off with on the board,
Yeah, I was
right?
on the board, yeah.
And then they needed a president to step in, so they asked you to do the job.
So I resigned. Well, when I say I resigned, I told my – so I reported to the COO, so I told her and the CEO, I need to leave, don't know what I want to do. I was single. I was kind of, you know, in my mid-30s going, this was never meant to be my life. I don't regret it, but whatever. And I went to a board meeting and with Midsummer, because I'd been on the board for a while there, and we're just chatting. They're like, oh, what are you up to? And I'm like, well, I actually quit my job today. So isn't that interesting? And then a month later, the festival director at the time, who we knew was going to be leaving, but that had to sort of speed up because her partner was needing to go overseas. The board sort of said, well, Tennille, can you do this one while we find somebody else to do the job ongoing? And I thought, oh, yeah, that'd be pretty fun. So at that stage, you know, the festival's kind of locked, everything's planned, the team was kind of doing what they've had been doing for a couple of years. I just needed to kind of come in and keep the ship sailing, so to speak. And during the festival, I kind of thought, this is actually really fun, which it is. It's a lot of hard work, but it was actually refreshing to be so connected with the people who were being impacted by it. And I remember actually getting lots of, I mean, like I had letters from people who had felt that Midsummer, you know, wasn't there for them. And then I had letters from people who were just like, oh, Midsummer's the best thing ever. And, you know, then, you know, you get your criticisms, oh, there's no shade at carnival and all of those sorts of things. But for me, it was this kind of amazingly connected to just community and this community that I'd been a part of, but to actually be in a position to sort of say, okay, what is the thing that we need to do? Mm. What are all of these things? How can we get them on the agenda to start ticking off? And then the other side of it for me was actually going back into the theatre space. So getting to work with venues like Gasworks and the Butterfly Club and all of these amazing venues kind of let me go back to where I started, which was theatre and film and television.
If you look back at your career, it almost does feel like certain things that you picked up along the way all of a sudden got to be utilised.
Yeah, things have happened. And I mean, even, you know, coming to Joy, I mean, that was something that I started working really closely with the team at Joy when I was at Midsummer, and then, you know, a couple of things changed at Midsummer, which meant I was looking for a different opportunity, and this just sort of happened at the same time. So yeah, it's been a kind of I've ridden the wave.
And now you're at Joy. I have these five questions that I have to ask you, so don't feel like you need to shorten these answers for me in any way, which I'm sure that you won't. What makes a good volunteer?
A good volunteer, oh my God, we've got some amazing volunteers here. A really good volunteer is somebody, I guess, who recognises that they either have a skill that can be utilised or they really want to develop a skill and that they are really passionate about the organisation that they want to volunteer with because they believe that, well, they can see that the organisation is bigger than an individual person.
Who's your favourite volunteer? You can say me. Who's your favourite? This is a trick question. You can plead the fifth there. What makes good on-air talent?
Oh, you know what? I think curiosity. I think that for me, that's the number one thing. Someone who's genuinely curious about the topic they're talking about is going to uncover something that is really interesting. And I think that is more important than knowledge.
Why should someone work at a community radio station?
There are a million reasons for that. I think community radio is not going anywhere. Community radio is a blessing that we have available to us in Australia that does allow us to have people connect with community virtually. So when we think about Australia and we think about how remote some people are, to be able to tune in and hear somebody with a shared experience talk about that, I mean, we talk about breaking down isolation, that's it.
It resonates.
And there's not many mediums of communication that we have that can do that. We say social media does, but it doesn't. Social media is, you know, that kind of instantaneous blurt out of something that you might regret in 5 minutes' time, whereas coming in and creating radio, particularly the way that people who do it here, we're planned, we really think about what we're talking about, and that's going to resonate and connect, and we know it does. Mm. When people are authentic and they talk about themselves or they're talking about a particular issue or a subject and they're really curious about it from a place of authenticity, what happens is we educate each other, we get to share that story with each other. And the thing that I'm always mindful of is we know that we've got about 400,000 monthly listeners, but we only, I mean, the people, we don't connect with those to find out, you know, how they're going, but they listen. So they clearly are listening for a reason, and we have to remember that all the time.
Who is working at their best game right now in radio, community and commercial? Like, who at this stage are you listening to?
Far out. Oh, in the community space, I think that there are a lot of stations who do some really great things for their community of interest. I think that PBS do an amazing job of getting really unique people with unique musical tastes and sharing that. So for me, that's a really interesting way to kind of to learn something new. I think the ABC do an amazing job of creating really, really poignant stuff. I got a lot of respect for SBS and the stuff that they do in the multicultural space. I think that television and radio for that's really amazing.
What about talent versus tenacity? What do you think makes someone more successful in this industry? Because if you look at it, there's a lot of people out there that are willing to spruik what they do.
Yep.
And then there's a lot of people out there that are very talented that don't. What do you think is what makes someone successful in this industry?
I think success is going to be tenacity. I think quality will always come down to talent. But unless you've got those two things firing at the same time,
it's never going to happen.
No, you're never going to be successful. So you mean you might get on the air if you're pretty tenacious, but if you don't have the talent to back it up, your time will be short-lived.
What are some of the challenges that you face being a woman, being the CEO of a business like Joy?
People not, I guess, understanding what my previous experience has been like, so just not understanding that. And, I mean, that's no one's fault.
Because if you think about it, like in the queer community, in the LGBTI space, it's very commonly, not in Australia but around the world, for a lot of organisations to be run by white gay men.
Yes.
And then to look at this job that you're in, it's really important and powerful for young people growing up to see that Tennille is the CEO, a woman in control, which is very different to what we've seen before.
Well, it can be. And I think we've had some great examples in Australia in particular. And when I came aboard with Midsummer, there was myself, there was Lisa Daniel at MQFF, there was Leanne running Switchboard, and then there was Conrad up here at Joy. So when Conrad left, all of those four organisations were being run by women.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
When you started at Joy, you obviously had a goal sitting out and you had some boxes that you wanted to tick, you know, to make this all work, which obviously involves change.
Yeah.
What was it that you originally set out to do?
So one was to look at the culture of the organisation. So any organisation that's been around for that stage, it was 23 years, the reasons that Joy started are amazing. And starting out with, a small group of volunteers and then that sort of growing, Joy'd reached this, I guess, kind of tipping point where you need to decide, are you going to just be a community organisation and, you know, stick a timetable up on the wall and if someone wants to have a show, they can have a show and, you know, that's all fine. Or do we actually want to be an organisation with purpose? So I was charged with actually looking at the culture and making sure that the culture was able to do two things. And one was to provide safe spaces for the entire LGBTI community. Because when I came on board was also when Joy changed that community of interest from gay and lesbian to LGBTI. So historically, it had always been an inclusive organisation. But when you are a gay and lesbian organisation that has some other stuff, that makes you inclusive. When you're an LGBTI organisation who doesn't quite fulfil all of that, you're not inclusive. So the kind of mandate around inclusivity and diversity changed a bit when I came on board. So we need to have a look at, okay, culturally, can we support that? And if not, how are we going to make that change? The other imperative was actually around revenue. So how are we going to diversify our revenue away from just donations, just memberships and on-air sponsorship? Because we know that those three things are becoming harder to get. So how can we diversify? Are there other ways for us to make money? So my job was to do those two things, to build an agile, inclusive culture within the organisation that was able to go forward into the future. And the current strategy that was designed and endorsed last year is all around the quality of our content. So creating content that can be shared across multiple platforms, and that content needs to actually be designed to achieve social impact for our LGBTI communities. That is kind of a step up from community radio station providing a voice for the LGBTI communities. This is now actually kind of saying that's going to be there. So we're always going to have opportunities for new people to come through. But what's that kind of 5 to 10% of our best content, and how do we get that further? How do we get that being shared, you know, the community radio network's one platform, but how do we get it out there further? How do we market the best of the best of our podcasts so that we're actually opening up this content to even broader audiences? How do we leverage this platform to tell the story and capture the experiences of LGBTI people who live elsewhere in Australia and the, you know, the Asia Pacific region and the rest of the world? And how can we be that beacon for LGBTI and allied people living anywhere in the world to look at it and say, wow, there's success that's attainable for us too? Because we kind of look out and say, oh my God, you know, it took us so long to get to marriage equality, but there are dozens and dozens of countries that don't even have what we have. So we need to continue to be that beacon, and we produce great content. That's always been here. It's just about taking that, finessing it, and actually purposefully pushing it out further.
Let's look at some of the headlines hitting the media right now, and I want to put a magnifying glass over what has become a huge question mark for people out there who are not in the know.
Mm-hmm.
These were some of the things that have been in the media. Data theft, bullying claims rock Australia's first gay radio station. Disagreements at community radio station Joy FM play out in public. And people try to kick out the board of Australia's only LGBTI community radio stations. Some of these people in a lot of these articles, they're putting your ability under question. They're questioning your ability, which, you know, is really hard. Is it hard to watch people scrutinize you in a public forum?
I guess, yeah. I mean, it's always going to be hard to see that sort of stuff, but I guess it's kind of switching into that cerebral part of your brain that rationalizes it. And I mean, I don't know these people. I haven't spoken to the people that are creating these headlines. So, you know, when you see those sorts of things, I mean, you kind of, that kind of comes with the territory, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I'm a woman in charge. I am going to be questioned. I think that from a community perspective, it speaks about the passion that exists with the people of this organisation. And I've never, from the day I walked in the front door, basically, I've always known that there's not a single person here at Joy who wants the worst thing for Joy. Everybody is incredibly passionate. And sometimes that passion is for a goal that is not the goal of the organisation. It might be a passion for the history of the organisation, or it might be a passion for what Joy means to them personally. But none of that's bad. I think that seeing some of those headlines has kind of picked up on issues that have, you know, been dealt with, or issues that will be dealt with if they're raised.
What are the truths in this story? I mean, obviously they couldn't get these stories published without actually looking at some of these truths. In your mind, was there anything reading these articles that you go, oh, I can see where they're coming from?
Oh, gosh. I think with any change program that you're driving, there are going to be people who understand it and get on board straight away. There's going to be people who just don't want it because it's different, or that they don't understand it, so they don't want it. And then there's a heap of people in the middle. We've got 320-odd volunteers here. So when I look at it, I have to look at it practically. I know there are a lot of hurt people out there. I know that the people who are speaking out are hurt. I would love the opportunity to understand what they're hurt about. I would like that. But I've also got 300-odd volunteers who are here, and I can say to you that the vast majority of these people are telling us that they're really happy with the culture of the organisation, that they feel like it's been fantastic over the last 12 to 24 months. The surveys that we do to have a look at engagement are telling us the same thing. So if that's the feedback that we're getting, that's what we can use. If people don't feel they can tell us the truth, then that's a whole other problem. I'd love to hear that, and we can try and work through that. But at the end of the day, we don't have children volunteering with us. We have adults. Everyone's at least 16 years of age, and we've only got a couple of people who are under 18. Everybody's an adult here. So there are processes that we have in place that have been in place for a number of years. There are people that you can come and talk to if you don't feel that your experience or your treatment has been appropriate. Come and talk to us about it rather than taking to social media, because all we're doing is we're taking an issue that is either a volunteer issue or a member issue, and we're putting it on a public stage, which is now being debated, and it reflects on Joy. Ultimately. So yes, it might reflect on me, and some people might get a few pot shots in against me, but I'll be honest with you, those people don't know me and I don't know them. The damage that it's been doing, the thing that cuts through this, is that everybody engaged in it knows Joy and they're forming opinions about Joy. And I'm kind of figure that we're all here to preserve Joy, it's a national treasure, as we say about it. So playing this out on social media is not going to achieve anything.
There's a great sense of entitlement that people afford themselves. Why do you think that exists in community radio? Because, I mean, I've heard that not from Joy. I hear that from community radio in general.
It makes sense to me. I think it's the same with any community organisation. If you're asking a group of people to give up their time, to donate money and to create something for other people, then it makes sense that a large percentage or a large part of their personality would be caught up in that. One of the first things I said to the whole team when I got here was, as a volunteer, or as anyone, but more so as a volunteer, you need to be really, really conscious that you understand when passion becomes a sense of obligation. Because the moment you're not passionate about something and you feel obligated to do it because I'm the only one who will ever do that. If I don't do it, no one else will do it. You know, everyone's relying on me to do it. And if you're overwhelming, or the dominant feeling is not coming from a place of doing because you love it, get out.
There's obviously different levels of satisfaction in what you've achieved so far. Is there something in particular, now looking back at your time here at Joy, that you feel that's what gave you the satisfaction?
If I look at all of the things that we kind of tick off and say, yeah, we've got, you know, nearly 400,000 listeners and 1 million podcast downloads and all the stuff we did last year, we created over 1,000 hours worth of Yes Campaign content. And we look at all of those things and this Mardi Gras broadcast that just keeps getting bigger and better. When you look at all of those things, I'm not responsible for any of those. My job is to make sure that the people who do those jobs, which are mainly volunteers, that the infrastructure exists for them to be able to do it, that the negotiation occurs so that we can leverage the partnerships that we need to be able to do it, that the money's in the bank so that we can actually do it, that we've got the right kind of engagement. My job is to coordinate and facilitate. That's my job. Ultimately, yes, I do have to make decisions, but fundamentally, I don't create the content. And I don't, you know, I'm not the voice that people tune into and say, yeah, that's, you know, I believe in that or I agree with that. That's not me. I'm the person who actually just ultimately gets to sit across the whole organisation and say, right, you guys are out there creating this great content. How can we support that and make the most of it? And I'm just engaging and facilitating everybody to try and work towards that goal.
We've been on a real journey with what sexuality means in Australia, and it's been a roller coaster over the last few years. Why do you think people for so many years were so scared and so fearful of a person's sexuality?
I think that's the same reason anyone's scared about anything that's different, because we're brought up believing one particular thing. We develop a set of values and a way that we exist around those. And when somebody challenges it, we have to challenge ourselves. We have to ask the question of ourselves, because so much of what we do is learned. You know, walking, we're obsessed with that, and breathing, once we don't even realize we're doing it, then that's perfection. As human beings, we've kind of got this obsession with being on autopilot. Like, I don't have to actually physically work. I just, my hands magically know where they're going. So the moment something comes along that's different, it's hard, because oh man, I've got to actually process that. I've got to think about it. We don't like to engage our brains, generally speaking. Anybody who is a fundamentalist who believes wholly and solely in one thing and anything that's outside of that is wrong, they will always be a danger to anybody who isn't in that little box. So wars are started over it. Peace is made over it. Like, this whole world, this whole life that we're all part of is going to go in cycles. And I think when you had Dustin Lance Black on, one of the things that always stands out for me in that is that we're always going to have this fight, but it's a noble fight. And I think that that is just so true. We are always going to be a minority. So whilst more people are becoming more accepting of the fact that there are different sexualities and different gender identities, and more people are saying, well, difference is fantastic and isn't that great, there will be more and more people who are going to be brought up in it with a very fundamentalist framework for their thinking, and they will oppose it.
I get chills when I think of Dustin Lance Black in particular, because that was a big wake-up call for me, because it was a really big wake-up call at the time that I spoke to him, because it was straight after marriage equality and we were living off this high.
Yeah.
We're like, woo, oh my God, things are going to be different forever.
And it's they not the goal.
Yeah, well, things are going to come back at us, and we are going to have to learn and remember what we were taught before and the strength that we had to keep bringing it again and again and again. And not just necessarily for the fights of the queer community, but also we can share that knowledge and know-how to other people, other minorities.
Absolutely. We have got a resilience in this community that you don't find often elsewhere. And that's, I've always believed that that resilience and that perspective, like I always think about, one of the things that makes me so proud to call myself, I don't use the word gay, I use the word lesbian because I'm a woman and I like to be a little bit different. But I always think about queer culture, mainly gay and lesbian culture, having this amazing, and my first experience in a gay bar was everything. So, you know, you're going up, you're going past Domino's and all the drongos downstairs and Surfers Paradise and running up the stairs to the beat. And, you know, you knew there was a chance you were going to get beaten up. It was 1995, like everyone got beaten up, but you still went to that bar. And you went past the drag queen who was intimidating because there were no security guards back then. It was a drag queen at the front door and they were intimidating. But once you got through there, everyone was just partying. We'd all run that gauntlet. Half of the people there had been beaten up. We all got upstairs and we partied. And I think that that resilience in our community to kind of take a really shitty situation and say, but you know what? I've got this. That's what we're about. And I think that that's what we need to remember is that we're never, I don't believe we'll ever truly achieve full equality because there's always going to be some threat there. There's always going to be a politician like a Cory Bernardi or whoever else kind of in the sidelines there talking about how we're perverted and we're this and we're that. And they will get some people looking towards them because anybody who is scared of change, who is scared that they're going to lose something, will jump on board with that. Mm. And that's just, that's life. And we will deal with it within our community and we will deal with it outside of our community. And we just have to remember difference is the thing that we should be fighting for. Difference is okay. We should celebrate it because it's amazing.
What impact did the Marriage Equality Campaign have on you?
Oh, it had a really interesting impact on me because I never wanted to get married.
I think the interesting thing about this is like, you know, what did this campaign do to you? Because the questions I have for you is because you've been with your partner for a while. Did you ever want to get married?
Never did. Never did until the day that that survey result came through. And it did weird things to me. I mean, I'd never wanted to get married even before I understood that I was a lesbian. Never wanted to get married. But that was always in the context of heterosexual weddings and heterosexual marriage. Then right up until that survey result, I didn't want to get married. I didn't want to participate in that kind of patriarchal construct. And then something happened on that day and all of a sudden I'm getting married and I'm really excited about that. Whether it was because there wasn't an option, so I just pushed it aside, I don't know. But there's a psychological thing there. But all of a sudden I've got this opportunity and that still hasn't sunk in, but we are going to get married, yes.
Well, is it going to be a long time before we see more trans people in media, do you think? Do you think it's going to take a while for us to be more inclusive in that way?
I think we're on this really interesting trajectory. So if you think about it, our community started out as gay and lesbian community and, you know, we fought that good fight for a very, very long time and then the community's kind of evolved, but we are expediting the messages and the involvement and the inclusion of everybody else within the rest of the acronym and then beyond. And I think we're seeing that happen a lot faster than we saw it happen for the gay and lesbian community. So I think the other thing that's interesting about that is when I was at Midsummer, I remember having a conversation with someone from the trans community who was saying to me, there's nothing in the Midsummer program for trans people. And I said, well, actually 10% of the program is, so that's technically over representation. But the fundamental thing is that if you want to see trans stories, then create trans stories. You need to, you know, you need to actually jump up on the platform and use it. There's no point me trying to tell a trans story because I will never understand that experience. There's no point me trying to tell a bisexual story because I'll never understand that experience and vice versa. So it's really, really important for people to realize that it's actually up to them. If they're sitting there saying, man, I just want to see something represented, you know, representative of my experience, then tell your story, whether it be in radio, whether it be through print media, whether it be put on a show, that there are so many options for people to do that, but we need the engagement and the involvement of those people. So once we kind of get through that, and I kind of look back and I say to people all the time, you know, gay men, you've always got a plethora of gay men wanting to tell their story because they've never been told they can't tell their story. They've always been told their story is infinitely fascinating. And around about the sort of late 80s, early 90s, lesbians were like, well, hang on a second.
We
hang
want some
on
of that.
A second. I'm going to claim this space for myself. And we need to start seeing that from the rest of the community. Don't wait for somebody to invite you to tell your story. Just bloody jump in there. I'm out there all the time trying to talk to different parts of the community that are underrepresented here at Joy to say, right, what's the barrier? What do we need to do? For Joy here, well, we offer scholarships to people who are from those minority or those smaller groups or the outliers, as we call them, because we don't have any representation from them. We know we don't have any, but we offer scholarships so that people don't have to pay for training. We offer coaching and mentoring so that we can get people's skills where they need to be. If you want to be part of this, you can be part of this.
I think that's an invitation from the CEO of Joy, that if you're out there and you are thinking that you've got an interesting story, you need to hit us up here at Joy.
Yeah, if we haven't told your story, come and tell your story, absolutely.
Have you got a message for the queer community that is listening to this show right now?
I would say that Joy is for everyone in this community. Joy is not just for the people that you hear every day. The people you hear every day are the people who have put their hand up and come in here and create this thing, but we can create a lot more. And with podcasting, we can create infinite amounts of content. So if you're out there and you don't feel that Joy represents you, then be that change and come in and join us, because the door is open. We have ways to make it easy for you to get involved, even if it's just in a supporting role, but you get an opportunity to share your experience with people. It doesn't matter. We are here and we're here for the whole community.
Well, you've got good stories.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks for joining us on Word for Word.
Thanks.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.